How many people watch SpongeBob SquarePants every week? The answer depends on the definition of watch. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally. SpongeBob is just one of many television programs owned by or under license with Viacom, a global media conglomerate. The popularity of its characters is measured not only by Nielsen ratings, but also by YouTube views. And thereby hangs a lawsuit. Joining Beyond the Book with news of a settlement this week in that case hinging on the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is Publishers Weekly senior writer Andrew Albanese. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Hey there, Chris.
So this is a big ruling in a case that's been sort of batting around since 2007. You've written about it throughout that period. So tell us what's involved here and how exactly things have turned out.
Yeah, this is the final chapter. With this settlement represents a final chapter in this long-running suit that I have found endlessly interesting. But it started in March of 2007 when Viacom sued Google for $1 billion, alleging massive copyright infringement on YouTube. In its filings, Viacom basically accused YouTube and Google of building this huge business on material that the company knew to be infringing, and they disputed Google's claims that it was a safe harbor under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. While the settlement doesn't really directly affect the book business, it really does. And I'll tell you why. Because copyright experts have seen the case as a pretty strong test of that Digital Millennium Copyright Act safe harbor provision. And as you know, that provision shields internet service providers from liability for the infringing behavior of its users. So some people might be posting stuff online to YouTube, and Google's not responsible for that content. They're only responsible for taking it down once somebody complains about it. So this case, you know, at one point, Google had actually won the case. In June of 2010, Judge Lewis Stanton held for Google, granting them summary judgment, and even praised Google for the way it handled its infringement complaints. You know, the present case shows that the DMCA works, Stanton wrote. You know, when Viacom, over a period of months, I think they sent out like 100,000 takedown notices, Google had them down by the next day. And that, Stanton said, was all Google was really required to do under the law. But in April of 2012, an appeals court reversed, and they remanded the case back to Stanton for trial. And next week, that was going to go back to trial, I believe, in Judge Stanton's court. So today, we've learned of the settlement, which effectively ends the case. And we heard a statement from Google and Viacom saying that, you know, the settlement reflects their growing collaborative dialogue and that they look forward to more working more closely together. Now, normally that would just be, you know, the kind of talk that you make when you're issuing a statement together. But I think in this case, it's pretty important because what we really do need, I think, in the digital realm is the collaboration between people like YouTube and content providers like Viacom. So I think rather than just empty words, that statement actually is a pretty good harbinger that maybe we're finally heading towards the right path, getting things out of court and actually working on good business settlements.
Well, Andrew, you mentioned the potential impact or the repercussions for the book business. Certainly there are some lessons here. Just as the world changed a great deal from the time the Authors Guild and AAP brought its original suit against Google for the book scanning case back in 2005. The world has changed a great deal online with regard to digital streaming content since 2007. And so you've got a player like Viacom doing important licensing deals and jumping from Netflix over to Amazon and really seeing their future, it would seem, online.
Absolutely. And, you know, and you're right. It really is amazing to look at how the online landscape has changed since 2007. You know, back in 2007, we were just in the very beginning stages of a lot of things. And, you know, what's really sort of changing things now is mobile and the way people are accessing the internet through apps. So that's also offered companies a more stable licensing venue, I think, going through mobile apps, etc. But, you know, this Viacom case was always seen as a real test of whether or not internet networks should be required to police their networks for copyright infringement, or whether or not the burden was going to fall on copyright holders to sort of play whack-a-mole and go after pirates one by one, and a pretty arduous process of sending out takedown notices every time they might have found somebody pirating their content anywhere around the world. And, you know, unfortunately, we're not going to get any clarity on that, but, you know, that may be a good thing.
Indeed. And, you know, in the digital Wild West, occasionally there are shootouts. We've just been talking about one, Google and Viacom. There's been another, much more closely related to the book world, that has also reached an important point in its development, in its evolution, as it were. We've got news that HarperCollins has won a judgment in its suit against Open Road, the ebook book provider.
That's right. You know, this is the case that we've talked about on this show a lot and that I've covered in depth. And it's a significant ruling, but still sort of limited in its significance. So just, you know, to briefly recap it, the case revolves around Jean Craighead George's 1973 best-selling book, Julie of the Wolves, which she published with HarperCollins and sold almost 4 million copies of, I believe. And George's agent had actually inserted a clause that was intended to, very broadly, prohibit HarperCollins from licensing the work in any sort of computer or mechanical means. And basically what that was intended to do, or so George contends, was to stop HarperCollins from licensing the book to abstracting services, et cetera, at the time. It was never really intended to be a publishing grant or to deal with ebooks. But the clause was so ambiguously written that the court actually ruled for HarperCollins that, you know, in concert with its publishing grant, that this mechanical language, that this computer language actually constituted a broad enough grant to HarperCollins where they could claim ebook rights here. Now, Open Road had come in and offered to publish the book for George with a 50% royalty rate. And this is really where the case, I think, turns. Even though it's a copyright case, it really, at its root, is a contract case. George's consent was still required to do any ebook edition with HarperCollins. So she went to them and she asked them to match Open Road's offer of 50%, which they refused to do. Thus, George went with Open Road. If HarperCollins had just simply matched the 50% royalty rate, we would have had no lawsuit. But they decided to stand on principle. And now that they've won, it raises some interesting questions about backlist books in general. Now, in its filings, HarperCollins had said all along that this was not a replay of the 2001 Rosetta Books case. And we all know the Rosetta case is where Random House was charging Rosetta with, you know, basically taking away its ebook rights. Well, the court agreed with Rosetta that the ebook rights were not specifically granted belonged to the author. But in this case, because the contract differed, and specifically it differed in one critical way, it had the word print in it. And the Random House, or it didn't have the word print in it. In the Random House contract, the original publishing grant was to print, publish, and sell in book form. That word print did not appear in the HarperCollins contract. And when you take in the ambiguous computer-related language that was in there as well, well, that was just too much for the judge, who held that HarperCollins, by a reading of the contract, did indeed possess the rights to publish the ebook. So Open Road is now going to have to walk away from its edition of this 1973 classic, pending an appeal. And we're not even sure that they're going to appeal.
Right. And while this is an important case for Open Road, the judge made a point, I believe, at least you reported so, that she does not think this is going to be having much of a ripple effect throughout the industry. This is a very specific clause in a single contract.
That's right. And this is actually Curtis Brown's language. This is not HarperCollins' boilerplate. So we don't even know that this is going to have a very big effect on HarperCollins' backlist. It may offer no clarity on backlist rights for deep backlist books for any publishing house. But I will say this. In the ruling, the judge did seem to narrow the Rosetta case a bit by throwing out that word print. So, you know, if some contracts, some boilerplates of certain major publishers don't include the words print, publish, and sell in book form, and just say publish in book form, well, maybe it changes the game a little. Maybe it changes how they look at this. I don't think that's really going to turn the way a publisher is looking about their backlist at this point. I don't know that anybody wants to wind up in court like these two parties did over a book like this. But nevertheless, we'll see.
Indeed. And, you know, from courtroom conflicts to digital disruption to legislative evolution, the conversation around copyright is definitely getting interesting. And since we've just been talking about copyright so far throughout the whole show, I'll mention to people that Copyright Clearance Center is hosting our own biannual symposium we call On Copyright 2014. It's coming up Wednesday, April 2nd at the New York Academy of Science. You can register for this free all-day event by going online to oncopyright2014.com. And Andrew, I'm hoping to see you there. I think we will get a chance to chat with you there. And the program, it's I have to say, as somebody who lives and breathes this stuff, is still pretty interesting. This is not your usual copyright conference. We've got Jeff Jarvis from Buzz Machine, James McQuivey from Forrester, Catherine Zaleski from Now This News. We're going to have a debate over the Beastie Boys parody or property case just concluded in its own courtroom, featuring a former musician turned copyright attorney. We're going to have our very own theme song debuted by Matt Farley, who's been making something of a living on Spotify and other online streaming music services. We're going to have P.J. Kuiper from the Motion Picture Licensing Corporation. So we really are looking at the business across the media spectrum, and anyone interested in joining us is welcome to do so. Go online at oncopyright2014.com for all the information and to register. And at the annual meeting of the Association of American Publishers, Hillary Clinton spoke in a keynote address that we understand really had a lot to say about the importance of copyright itself and the potential for copyright reform.
That's right. You know, we have, I think the publishing industry has a pretty good tradition of having future presidents, and assuming Hillary's going to run and win, of speaking to them. I know they had Barack Obama actually address them at one point, too, and they had Hillary Clinton this week at a much-anticipated talk in which she was speaking about, the theme of her speech was the next chapter in protecting IP, policy disruption, innovation, and sustainability. And we will have a complete report on that on the Publishers Weekly website, as well as in the magazine on Monday, so you should check that out. And I'll just add another endorsement for what you said for the On Copyright event. Chris, I have to tell you, this has always been one of my absolute highlights. Every time you've had one, they've been great programs. They're very educational, they're far-reaching, they're entertaining. I just find them tremendous, and I'm excited there's another one this year, and you will definitely see me there.
Well, that's great. And, you know, I won't be there, but I know a number of my colleagues will be there, and I'm sure you will be at the London Book Fair. There's a preview in the upcoming issue on that show as well.
That is right. This is our annual London Book Fair preview, and I will be in London as well. Always a great fair in the city of Shakespeare. And in Monday's issue, we will have our London briefcase from Rachel Deal, who will be outlining all of the big books and rights that agents and publishers, I should say, will be bringing to London for potential licensing deals. And also a little look at the program and some of the professional events that you can expect to see in London. And of course, copyright and copyright related issues are always a big part of the fair over there.
Right, indeed. And you know, London Book Fair, that's a show that's been coming on strong in the last few years, really much more important than it ever was.
Certainly, very, very strong. And I think that they're going to actually be bolstered by, they recently struck an agreement to keep the show in West London. They had been talking about, actually, because Earl's Court, where it currently is held, is actually being demolished, I believe. So they had been talking about possibly moving it out to the Docklands again, and people were grumbling about that. But you know, they just announced this year that they've struck a long-term deal to keep the London Book Fair in its West London location. Made people very happy, and the attendance at that show, you're right, has risen steadily over the last years, barring that 1 year where an Icelandic volcano kind of knocked out everybody. So I'm really looking forward to the fair this year and its continued growth, and I expect that it's going to continue to grow in coming years. It's a very popular place to have a book fair, wouldn't you say?
Indeed. Well, oh, to be in England now that April's there. That's what everybody will be saying in just a few weeks' time at the London Book Fair. Andrew Albany, senior writer for Publishers Weekly, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow us on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, beyondthebook.com. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.